Let's pray. Father who is in heaven, your name is, your character, your person, your fatherhood is so above all. We speak of it, we speak way beyond what we live at times, and God, I ask that you would bring our words in our mouths, our words in our feet closer together today. Call us hypocrites when we say one thing about you and live a different way. And so God, I ask that you would cause us to be less of hypocrites. More real and more living in truth, because that is the way that we will know joy and peace and happiness and contentment and power. So God, we look to you to teach us today. Look to you to protect this place. Protect our ears, protect our hearts, protect our minds. In the name of Jesus, I ask that your spirit would pervade and rule. Teach the children, cause them to be different in their perception of you and what dads look like and what a dad looks like and ultimately what you as father looks like. I thank you for the privilege of having your word and being able to study it and be formed by it, and God, cause us to be transformed by it. Amen. So here we are. Last week we started James after being in the Old Testament for a long time. Again, still miss it, but it's been pretty sweet to jump into James. There's a lot there. Like I said last week, James seems to be rather than a flowing book, it's a whole bunch of short little, statements, short little, tidbits of truth strong, real strong. So a lot of the stuff in James is incredibly strong, strong to the point where people don't like James, the book of James, because it speaks strongly. So I'm excited for it, excited to spend the next weeks there going through James. Last week we started it, and read the first 8 verses again. That's one of the good things about it. It's short. It's not like when we're in Samuel and there's books are long. So James, a bondservant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes who are dispersed abroad, greetings. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials. Again, these are verses that we should all have memorized, embedded in our hearts, something that is able to be recalled in the context of struggle. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its perfect result, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. That I don't think there's probably not too many truths that are more consistently brought up to try to deal with life than that truth. It encounters a lot of, or encompasses a lot of things. And that word trials, again, is temptations. And I would, the thing that made me think I need to go back, I thought about last week and we talked about it, and there's just some things that I just don't think can be overemphasized. The word, again, is temptations. And we tend to immediately think of temptations as sexual. Potentially that could be, but temptations are, and the word is really testings, trials, temptations, and testings. Really, it's the same word in the Greek. And the thing that we need to consider is, when we encounter various temptations, this isn't just about sexuality. There's temptation is the urge or the desire to act out in a way other than what God calls us to act out in. So how are we, the thing that I want to make real clear and reorient, it's we get so consumed and determined by circumstances, and it's not about the circumstances. It doesn't matter, tough times, easy times, rich, poor, whatever is in front of our face that might be a test. We need to understand and always fall back on the baseline that we would probably everybody in this room would say with their mouth, but it's a much different thing to live it out, and that God is sovereign. And that God is omniscient, that He's all-knowing. And that God is omnipotent, that He's all-powerful. In other words, nothing happens outside of the power and authority of God. Now, there's a lot of things in our lives there's things in our lives that aren't godly at times. So what does that mean? Well, there's two forces at work in this world. The enemy's at work, and God's at work. Well, nothing happens outside of God allowing it. Okay? So the circumstance is not the issue that should determine us, no matter how it causes us to be stressful, fearful, self-reliant, sinful, which all those things are, self-reliant is sinful, not trusting God is sinful. The temptation is when the circumstances are tough, or when the circumstances in front of us are a challenge, whether that's a sexual challenge, whether that's a financial challenge, whether that's an emotional challenge, what do we do? How do we respond to it? Because that's the testing. That's the temptation, as it were. Okay? That's the trial that God allows. Now, there's trials that, again, God does not tempt with evil. It says this a little bit later. Okay? So what God allows in our lives, does God test us? God tests us. Okay? God tests us because He loves us, because He cares, because He wants us to be mature, because He wants us to grow up. Most of us, want the privileges of an adult, of a mature person, just like a kid, right? They want all the privileges and rights of, I want to determine when I go to bed. I want to determine what I can watch. I want to determine if I can ride my bike outside or not. I want to determine what I can do. They want the privileges without the responsibility of an adult. We tend to be the same way in our immaturity in the faith. And our immaturity in our relationship with God is that we want the privileges, but we really don't want to do what's associated in acting responsibly. In other words, it says, let endurance have its perfect result that you may be perfect and complete. That word perfect is mature. That's what the word means. It means complete, means mature. We get caught up and we'll get hung up pretty easy in the word perfect because, well, nobody's perfect, right? I mean, what more prevalent statement is there in this day and age, right? Nobody's perfect. I mean, it's almost an immediate response to sin in our culture, right? Nobody's perfect, right? The word perfect means mature, okay? It means grown up. It means that you have steadfastness, that you're mature. And mature means that you do the right thing. I mean, that's the differences in maturity, right? Maturity means that you respond correctly to things around you. You're not determined by your emotions. You don't act selfishly. You act in other people's best interests. You do things in a mature way, not in an immature way or a childish way, which you could say is a selfish way, right? Children are they're born that way. They're born in the flesh. They're born determined by their feelings, by their emotions, by their stomach, by their whatever. And it's our process to bring them into maturity to not be determined by those things, but to determine by right and wrong, determined by what the authority over them says, be determined by God ultimately, And that's what our purpose as parents is, as stewards of those children for the few years we have them, is to teach them submission of their will to the authority over them, because that's what maturity is. Rather than acting immaturely, which is just acting out on your emotions or how I feel right now. So the response to circumstances, and all of us struggle in circumstances. God allows circumstances. God tests. It's throughout the Bible. It's pretty comprehensive. But there was a couple things that I was looking at that are, straight up saying that God tests. That when God called the Israelites out of Egypt, and again, that calling the Israelites out of Egypt, I would challenge all of you to go back and there's a chance we might go back and do Exodus at some point, the book of Exodus, doing it just because it's such, God put it there as a picture of Him calling us out of the world. And it's really important to look at it and read it. It's not just a history lesson about a bunch of grumbling people stumbling around the desert. It's a vivid picture of God calling us out of the world. Remember, God called them out of the world, and just like us, and the sons of Israel said to them, the whole congregation of Israel was grumbling. In Exodus 16, verse 2, the whole congregation of Israel was grumbling against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the sons of Israel said to them, "Would that we had died at the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat and we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." Right? Whining, right? I mean, that sounds like what all of us have said at times, God, why? Why have you let circumstances be like this? Why are things like this? Why do things look like this? Why is my spouse such a pain in the butt? Why is whatever, We all grumble and say, "God, why? Why did you allow this?" And it's amazing. God's response was, the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. And the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day that I may test them whether or not they will walk in my instructions." So God brought them out of Israel, out of Egypt. And again, it's a sweet walk to watch, that he took, where he took them and the road that he took them down. He took them again. He led them way, rather than going straight across. And it's very important for us to understand, because it's what our life looks like. We always think, "God, it'd be so much easier if you just gave me the money to pay my bills. God, it'd be so much easier if you just changed these circumstances. God, it'd be so much easier if you just changed my husband or my wife. God, it'd be so much easier if you didn't have circumstance like this. God, why do you allow circumstances to be like this?" And you think about him taking them from Egypt. Again, Egypt was over here, and here's where he's taking them, is right here. And instead of going like this, what did he do? He led them clear down in the desert to Mount Sinai. Clear down through this really ugly desert. Clear down, or rough, harsh, ugly, dye, inhospitable desert. Clear down here and up here. And he says the reason that he did it was that they would learn to trust him. So they learned to fear him, to test them. Right? I mean, so often we look at it and go, "God, we're right here. Why can't you just let us go here?" He says, "No, I'm going to take you on a ride to test you. I'm going to take you there because, why? Because he's just mean? Because he's, got an evil streak in him? No, because he loves us. Because he wants us to grow into maturity and learn to trust him. And in those trials, in that testing that he gave them going through the wilderness, it was sweet. You're going to have to learn to trust me. How does this work? Okay. You guys are, want to be spoiled rotten, and see, it's the same with us with money, I mean, I think instead of the food part of it, we should put money in us, because our culture isn't so much worried about food. We're pretty spoiled when it comes to food. Our culture is, they're worried about money in the same way, right? We want to see a big pot of meat right there so we know we have enough. And we want to see bread left over. And we want to see bread in our cupboards. And we want to see, you know, same thing with money. You know, we don't want to live day by day. We don't want to live trusting God in that way. And he said, okay, they were on a different level of subsistence, but it's the same heart. They didn't want to trust God. So what did he say? I mean, the whole manna thing is a pretty profound deal, right? I mean, he said, you will go out and you will gather. When you read the story about it, I challenge you guys to read that story about it. You know that he said, okay, this is how I'm going to do it. Every morning when you get up, the dew will turn into kind of like hoarfrost and it'll morph into edible food, okay? And it'll be there about long enough till the sun comes up. And when the sun comes up, then it'll melt away and be gone. But if you collect it at that time and collect it just enough for the day, no more, but enough for the day, not for tomorrow, not for the next day, you collect it enough for today, then you'll have plenty to eat. Okay? You collect more than that, then they did. They collected more than one day during the week. Worms came in. And eat up and got consumed with worms, okay? Except on Friday night, okay? On Friday morning. On Friday morning, they collected enough for the Sabbath. Because God said, I don't want you to collect it on the Sabbath. So when they collected double amount on Friday, it didn't go bad. Sunday would have gone bad. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. So God set this up to say, I want you to trust me. And I want you to do it my way. And he did to test to see if you will be obedient. And we need to understand that whenever things are tough, financially, emotionally, circumstantially, relationally, oftentimes, I mean, tragically, our rebellion has caused the position we're in. Okay? And that's tragic. And shut up and quit whining. But the truth is, God is still in charge, and God still wants to use that to cause you to trust him more and go into a deeper relationship with him. It doesn't say the testing of us produces endurance. It says the testing of our faith. It says the testing of what we claim about God to be true, putting it to the test. In temptation, the biggest, you know, what are we tempted in? It's not just, we tend to think we're tempted in sexual sin is a pretty prevalent, obvious one that virtually all of us on some level have struggled with in this room. But it's just as much a temptation to not trust God, right? That is a temptation. Not trusting God is a sin. When I'm in a circumstance that I don't like, financially we are tempted to do the wrong thing. It isn't the financial issue that's the issue. God promises to take care of his children. You're going to put that to the test? Because he promises that, okay? Instead, what do? Frustrated, angry, discontent. Do we cry out to God for wisdom? It says if you cry out to God for wisdom, he gives to all men generously and without reproach. It will be given to you. Except, it says, but let him add. But is a but. That means there's qualifications here. But let him ask in faith without doubting, for the one who doubts is like the surface of the sea. We tend to look at that and go, doubting. Well, gosh, you know, how can I help it? I don't really trust him. You know, I don't trust. I didn't have a dad I could trust. I don't trust him as a dad. I don't have a, you know, I don't trust. I'm not too. That's not what it's talking about. It's talking about being a double-minded man, which means, well, God, I want your wisdom about this and what to do and how to act like this. I need to know what to do in the circumstance. The issue is, and let me know, God, so I can decide if I'm going to obey or not. Let me know what you think, God. Let me know what I'm supposed to do here so I can figure out if I'm going to submit to it or not. I mean, give me my options here. Do I take this over or, God, you got another way? Let me know. Let me balance the two. See which one I want to take care of doing it. Now, we would very seldom outwardly and overtly say that with our mouth. But we act that way. And that's being a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. Don't expect that a man will receive anything from the Lord being a double-minded man. Are we willing to be submissive? God, I need your wisdom what to do. I'm willing to be submissive to you in it. No matter what that looks like. Financial things, and I would say financials, you know, financials for us look a lot like the Philistines did for the Israelites. You know? There's few things in our culture that we, you know, is it debt? Is it paying off? Is it needing to pay bills? Is it wanting to buy this or buy that or a different house or a different car or my car broke down or whatever it is? Financial things tend to pound the heck out of us. And we need to be very careful that as a child of the King, that we do not let the circumstances determine our actions and our responses. That's what happens. It isn't about the circumstances. God is in control of the circumstances. Now, sometimes he lets the enemy is always purposely working circumstances to destroy us. Okay? Don't get me wrong there. So, you know, if, you know, temptation, so God does not tempt with sin. God does not tempt with evil. The enemy does. God allows it. God allows the enemy to, you know, God allowed at one point there to be false prophets. He allowed false prophets to come in to deceive the people, to see who they would follow, to see who they'd obey in doing, to see what they wanted. Did they listen to what their ears wanted to hear and what their ears wanted to be tickled by, or were they willing to stick with what God had said? God allows the enemy to come in and act in our lives, but the issue is God still in control? And how will I respond? Will I respond with anger towards God? I know that one. Let me just tell you from experience, that's a really bad thing to do. But we're all tempted to be angry at God, right? God, why didn't you? Or why did you? Or why did you allow this? If you're in charge, how come things are like this? And why did you allow this to be? Being angry at God is sin. And it's utterly, it is insanity, honestly. Because the true character and nature of God, there is no call to be angry at him. And it is one of the more destructive responses you can have towards God, and it comes from being deceived. God, it isn't the way I wanted it. Wasn't the way I would do it. It isn't the way I think about it. So I'm mad at you for that. The issue is how the temptation is, the trial is, how do we respond to circumstances? Not the circumstance. Okay? And it's really important you look at that. When we come to a financial thing that's beating the heck out of us and we're doing it and we get consumed by it and it makes us angry and it makes us scared and it makes our stomach hurt and it makes us wake up at night and it makes us do all kinds of things that are a response not of trusting God. And that doesn't mean you sit on your butt and do nothing. He says, ask, if you need wisdom, ask for wisdom on what to do, but be willing to do it. Be willing to be obedient, and God will give you the wisdom in what to do. So, I just want to emphasize that the issue isn't the circumstances around us. The issue is our response to those circumstances. Okay? And that is where we either become mature, when we grow, and we prosper in our faith, and we prosper in our relationship with God, or we sin. By how we respond to circumstances, okay? It goes on to say, verse 9 of James, it says, but let the brother of humble circumstances glory in his high position, and let the rich man glory in his humiliation, because like flowering grass he will pass away. For the sun rises with a scorching wind and withers the grass, and the flower falls off, and the beauty of its appearance is destroyed. So too the rich man in the midst of his pursuits will fade away. I don't know that there's a more relevant verse for the American culture. Because there is a relenting desire and lust for financial, to be financially a little ahead of where we are right now. Okay? I mean, there's this, if only, you know, you look at somebody, you know, that is struggling in poverty and they go, man, if I had $10,000, oh my gosh. I mean, my life would be good, you know. But you look at somebody that has $20,000, what do they say? Man, if I had $50,000, I would be happy. Really? Ask the $50,000 guy what he says. Is he happy? No. Are you kidding me? I'm barely making it. You can't even live in this valley like that, right? I mean, come on. How can you expect me to be happy? You can't even live at 100,000, you know? Okay, but what's that guy doing? He's happy? Content? No. What's he say? If I had $1 million, I'd be happy, right? You know what the guy with $1 million says? Inevitably? If I had 10 million, now I'd be happy. Is he happy? How about the guy with 10? The good thing about this valley, they're here. The guy with 10 million, is he happy? No. He's not happy. What's he want? 100 million, okay? Then I'll be happy. I mean, come on. If I just had a yacht, you know, then I'd really be happy. You look at, this culture is very hard for us to separate because we are spoiled, rotten, rich. Every one of us in this room, relative to the world, spoiled, rotten, rich. Most of us drove here, in a car today, right? I mean, come on. In most parts of the world, that is like a king, you know? A high percentage of the world. That's a very rare thing. We have clothes, we have food, right? We're not going to go home tonight and it's kind of cold and worry about shivering. We can go over that little thing on the wall and turn it up and it'll probably come on. Probably had enough money to pay the bill. If not, they're probably gracious to us for a little while. We live in utter affluency relative to the world. So it's really hard for us to gauge because we sit here as we're just low life Paley or Bellevue people, you know, doing, you know. And we, you know, we're just and we look at those, we're not catching people. I mean, come on. We're just barely living, just barely getting by. And we tend to compare ourselves to this valley, which would be a ridiculous thing to do on a world scale. You know, I've always felt, you know, when we were first married, I remember, you know, we didn't have anything and didn't know anything and didn't have anything, you know, and we're living up in the mountains in a little 1957 Bulls Arrow trailer, you know, little 24 foot trailer with no electricity or running water and hand dug a well and used a rope and bucket and it was just stinking sweet, man. Wish I was still there, but it was, we had the sweetest outhouse, you know, face the sun in the morning, you know, it was wonderful. But anyway, I know, it doesn't seem like a good thing, but a little lime, it's all good, you know, you're outside, life's good. So, but nonetheless, pardon my distraction. And I remember at the time going, okay, God, how do we live? How should we live? You know, what does it look like in light of the world situation? Because I have brothers and sisters, literally, family of God all over this world. And someday we're going to meet. Someday we're going to meet up in heaven. We're going to hug and we're going to shake hands and we're going to do it. And they're, you know, am I going to be able to look them in the eye and go, oh, man, you know, the way I ate caused people to starve to death. Ooh, the way I lived caused, you know, what does that look like? Right? How does it look? Was my lifestyle lived at the expense of other people? Or did I live my life for other people? And I don't know that we, you know, I'm not, you know, there's a huge political mess right now. I understand. You know, I'm not an isolationist. Screw the rest of the world. We just got to take care of ourselves. Okay? And I'm also not give everything we have away, because that's not going to help anything either. Okay? I mean, because this world, there's, you know, giving things away and give is doesn't help. I mean, you know, at this point we have a huge, quote, poverty rate. We have a huge welfare state in our own culture on doing it. People that don't want to work, people that don't trust God, you know, Jesus said, the poor we will always have with us. So, but on the other hand, what does my lifestyle look like? Is it valid? Isn't it valid on doing that? And you know, that is something that I think is somewhat relative to the culture you live in, doing it, and the culture that God puts you in. That's not an excuse for hedonism. It's not an excuse for selfishness. It's not an excuse for gluttony or lusting after material things, materialism or pleasure seeking. I mean, this valley is hedonistic on a degenerate level, right? We live in this valley. People live in this valley for pleasure, right? To self-pleasure and to pleasure themselves. And that's, you know, is that right? No. That's not right doing it. What does it look like? Are we content and willing to be content with subsistence living? One of the great things that we need to overcome in our mentality is subsistence living is despised in our culture. Okay? If you're subsistence living, you're a loser. If you're collecting manna every day and trusting God to give you manna the next day, you're a loser. I mean, you know, you're not going anywhere. You're not doing anything with yourself. Why don't you make something happen? Why don't you do something with yourself? We don't, you know, that which is insane relative to the rest of the world. There's a great percentage of the world, millions, count it billion plus that are, if they could get up and have enough food and shelter and heat and clothes to get through the day, they're happy. They're living like kings, okay? In our culture, we despise that. And the weakness is that we do exonerate wealth. And I would challenge all of us in this culture and particularly in this room to deal with that. Because we should not honor and envy wealth. And we do. It's almost inevitable in this culture. We tend to directly assimilate prosperity with God's blessing. Okay? And we tend to, we look at less or not having or subsistence living, much less poverty, living in poverty is the result of sin. And we directly do that, and it's so ingrained in us that it's hard to get rid of. It's a subconscious thing that comes in. And we have whole churches, you know, that preach a doctrine of prosperity, right? If you have a right relationship with God, you will prosper, okay? It's not in the Bible. You will prosper monetarily. It's a dogma of materialism in the church in America. And unfortunately, we have transmitted it everywhere. You know, we transmit it to Africa. I mean, their Christian doctrine over there is completely, they watch Christian broadcasting TV stuff, you know, that says, if you're right with God, you will prosper. You'll have money. You know, send us your $50 and God will bless you and you'll have five times that fold, you know, doing it. They're just, they equate directly prosperity to the extent that they work very hard to, you know, what is their acceptance within social culture of Christian church? You replicate or look like you're prosperous and you're doing well. And therefore, everybody around you acknowledges, oh, you're right with God doing it, you know. We don't tend to dress that way and do that this way in this culture. We tend to equate it though pretty hard, right? If your church has a building program, God must be blessing you. You know, if your church is affluent and going, God is blessing this church. You know, I mean, look at Joel. I'll say it outwardly. You know, I don't believe Joel Osteen is speaking the word of God on doing it. I think he's preaching a false doctrine. He's not preaching what the Bible says. What does James say here? He says, let the brother, the church member, the brother of humble circumstances glory in his high position. And let the rich man glory, as it would be, in his humiliation, because like flowering grass, he will pass away. It's not something that we should envy. It is absolutely, utterly temporal. When you die, it's no more. You know what? And we're all going to die soon. Some of us sooner than others, but relatively speaking, soon. Okay? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how much you have. I mean, they try to do the funeral where you put the, bury the Cadillac in the ground or something. It ain't going with them though. You know? It's not going with them. You do not, we're not taking anything with us. God says it is a false pursuit, and we are not to honor wealth in our culture. The truth, what he's speaking and setting us up for here is, if we exonerate so highly prosperity, financial prosperity, what do we do when we're struggling financially? How do we respond to that trial? How do we respond to that time? You know? Are we willing to trust God? I mean, most of us need to ask wisdom of God and be willing to be less greedy and less lustful and less desiring of things and, you know, not consumed by that, not thinking it's to make us happy. I mean, there's a amazing, if you living in this valley for almost 30 years now, you know, there's an amazing, you know, distinction that we tend to mock from my position in financially versus other people in this valley financially, because you see it. But it doesn't matter on what level it is. We believe that money buys us happiness. When I'm discontent, when I'm unhappy, you know, I might say, well, come on, let's go get some ice cream, you know, or I don't say that, but you know, something like that, you know, let me go shoot or something, you know, let me go ride my motorcycle or something, you know, doing it, you know, do something to make me unhappy. Now, I'm not saying it's wrong to do things, but we tend to think of buying things. In this culture, it's really different, you know, we're not doing well, we're struggling, we're not happy, we're discontent. Let's go to Hawaii, right? Or let's go to France, right? Or let's buy a new yacht. Or, and we look at them and we mock them and go, oh, you wasteful, rich people. God, the money doesn't matter. God looks at the heart. If we try to displace our discontentment, lack of peace, through money, and money is what we use, right? I mean, if I just had a little bit more money to buy a little better food or a little better clothes or, I mean, all of you can think about that thing that rings in your ear a little bit, right? If I just had a little bit more money to get this or that, or to do this or that, right? Then I would be happier. Then I wouldn't be so discontent. Then I would feel better about life. When you have that mentality, it's very difficult to respond to what God uses, because God uses financial things. God uses circumstances to teach us maturity, to cause us to grow. And are we content and trust Him and go, God, you know, I'm in this situation and, you know, you've allowed me to be in a situation. I probably caused some of it, and God, please teach me, and I'm willing to be taught by you how to not be irresponsible and greedy, because most of us get in trouble because we're greedy and trying to fulfill lustful desires on doing it. And so we end up in a tough place financially, and then, oops, then we say, God, help me. Well, should have probably asked Him before what you should have done and what you shouldn't have done. So the issue is, it is not about the circumstance, but I believe he throws this section in here that in our culture, man, it is very hard. As long as we have the perspective that money will make us happier, okay? That greater, a little more money will make us happier. And all of us, none of us would consider ourselves greedy, right? You know? None of you in this room probably imagine jumping immediately to the billion deal. God, I need $1 billion or I'm not going to be happy, right? Right? We're probably not, I mean, literally, right? We don't do that. We don't think, oh, God, $1 billion. No, I'm not greedy. Just a few hundred or a few, maybe 1,000 or something, you know, so I could do this. I mean, I'm not greedy, you know? I just want, when we have the mentality that money will make us happy, we're not going to respond to the trial correctly, to the tough time correctly. Do we literally trust that God says, look at the lilies of the field, you know? They're here today and gone, just like He says it here. They're here today and gone tomorrow, right? Like the scorching wind. The sun rises, the flowering grass will pass away. The sun rises with the scorching wind withers. And yet He says in Matthew, Jesus said, and look at how amazing in the effort that God puts into dressing those. I mean, I love wildflowers. I'm not just a stinking hippie, okay? I love, my kids harass me, but not, okay? So, don't be making fun of me for loving wildflowers. I love wildflowers, okay? And there was slight, Ben. I did drive Volkswagen bus at one time in college, so, you know. But, okay, it's when you look at wildflowers, they're amazing. I was just up on top of, hiking on top of a hill yet last night. And I mean, it was just, I was just in glory. I mean, it was just wildflowers everywhere. And these exquisite, beautiful wildflowers. That God, why does God do that? Today they're here and tomorrow they're gone and they pass away. He says, if I care that much about those things, how much more do I care about you who are eternal beings that I created to spend the rest of eternity with? And you're worried about your clothes? And you're worried about your food? You know, look at the birds. You know, they don't sow, they don't plant, you know, nor do they reap, but look at them. You know, they're content, they're taken care of. God says, you look at those things, he goes, I will take care of you. Go seek first my kingdom and my righteousness, and all these things will be taken care of. Now we all read that. Go ahead and read it in Matthew. You know, it's in the Sermon on the Mount. Read it. Okay? So you're either going to say, God, you're a liar, or my life really needs to be different. And I really need to look at things differently. You probably won't want to outwardly say God's a liar, but it doesn't matter what you say with your mouth. It's what you do with your life. Okay? If you're not willing to go, okay, God, I'm going to trust you. You say you care about these things that are here today and gone tomorrow. I'm going to trust you. Okay? So having that context with money, particularly in our culture, I really think is important, and with material things, because we are probably the most hedonistic and materialistic society ever on the face of the earth. By the way, that's not a good historical perspective to have about the time we live in and the people we are. And unfortunately, we tend to gauge ourselves, you know, relatively, you know, right? But I'm not one of those guys, right? I mean, I don't have a jet, you know. You know, I have an old car, you know. I'm not one of those guys on doing. I mean, they have a summer house up here. I mean, they're opulent. They're decadent in doing it. We tend to judge ourselves that way rather than in a realistic perspective. God doesn't really care about the amount. It's about the heart. It doesn't matter the amount. You know, I would honestly say that, I mean, Jesus said time and time again, it's harder for a rich man, the perspective that it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than a camel to fit through the eye of a needle. And that's really, I don't think it has anything to do about a cute little door that you could get underneath next to the gate where the camel had to get on his knees and not tumble and think that's a crock of baloney. Okay? That's really not what it's talking about. It's talking about stuffing a camel through the eye of a needle. How's that going to go? Wouldn't want to try it. I wouldn't want to stick a cat through the eye of a needle, much less a camel through the eye of a needle. Okay? Harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. So is that something we should go, I wish I was rich? Seems like a pretty scary thing, right? Is money the problem? Money isn't the problem. Lack of trust is a problem. Self-reliance is a problem. Lusting after money, materialism is a problem. And Jesus continuously warned against it. So if Jesus continually warned against it, you know, wouldn't the prosperity doctrine look something like, you know, like our opiate thing, you know? I mean, you know, is there a place for opiates? Yeah, maybe, you know. I mean, I had some surgery, you know, and I'm glad they did something rather than just lay there completely sober while they cut me open, you know. Went through and grounded my back, you know. It was kind of nice. You know, I didn't have to straight up feel that deal. But, so, you know, you deal with your kids that way, you know, because it's a good thing and there's a place for it and it's valid and go, you know, if you don't feel good or, if you stubbed your toe, here's some opiates. Here's some Norco. Would you do that to your kid? Why? Because it's like really dangerous? Right? Why would God do it with money to us? He wouldn't spoil us like that. It'd be like spoiling your child with opiates. Because most aren't going to get past it. Most aren't going to get through it. Most are going to become addicted to it and be destroyed by it. And Jesus speaks the same way of riches and money. Do we need enough? Do we need to get by? I'm glad you guys had enough gas to get to church today in a car to do it. By the way, if you didn't, I'll pick you up. And if I don't, I would ask you to pick me up. Okay. Could be. Okay. But that we need a certain amount. I'm not saying that, we should necessarily go home, shut the heat off and curl up in a blanket. Not necessarily all bad, but, but especially with my wife, it's a nice thing. But the issue is, what part does it play in our psyche of happiness? In our level of desire? And I would contend that most of us have a lust for money and materialism. That means a desire that's out of control, an insatiable desire for. We tend to think of lust, again, we tend to put it in the context of sexuality almost immediately. But that wouldn't be the way the Bible even puts it, okay? Yeah, there is lust of the flesh, which would incorporate sexuality and sexual sin and sexual perversion. But again, God says that I am to lust after Him. Right? That has nothing to do with sexuality. That has to do with have this insatiable desire and longing for Him. Okay? And I'm supposed to. You use the same word. Okay? Thing is, never supposed to lust after money or materialism or anything but God. Okay?
And what really struck me was, I had somehow stopped believing in God's provision, not intentionally, but I did, and I was looking at that as security. Mm-hmm. And partially worldly wisdom, that we should have this, or whatever. And in that way, the struggle was like, gotten rid of it. Mm-hmm. It comes up in November, oh well. Mm-hmm. We're done with it, because I promise that we need to claim and not be buying into the others would consider a wise decision to be secure. It's not a wise decision when you look at income versus what that bill would be. So I think, I don't always think about it as less after more money, but you created a security. Mm-hmm. And that's not where it's supposed to come from anyway. So. Mm-hmm.
And that's when, we are tempted. And this is where the verse come after that. Let me read it. Because I agree with that. And the weakness is, are we going to be determined by our culture? I would challenge every one of us in this room, just try to outgive God. Try it. Your life will be utterly blessed. Okay? Most of us don't. Most of us are just kind of stingy because maybe he's not paying attention. Maybe he doesn't know I really need that $100, man. I mean, come on. Maybe he's not paying attention, Or maybe he's like going to be slow to like pay it back, And I got to get this bill paid, And maybe he won't, it's not, maybe he's busy right now. Maybe he's on vacation, and he's not going to do it. And, we tend to not trust God. God's New Testament view of tithing is? None of it's yours. Give it all away. None of it's yours. That's his New Testament version of tithing, okay? Is that the way we live? No. We're miserly, okay? We're miserly. As a result, no wonder we struggle with finances. No wonder we are worrisome. Because we don't put our faith, what we say we believe about God, to the test. It's a ridiculous kind of, a little kid trying to give to his dad. Okay? If dad's a loving dad, can a little kid outgive his dad? No way. No way. You know, his dad's going to give back tenfold, right? When he sees that heart and that desire to be generous, to be caring, to give of something that's important of him, you know. I've got two pieces of candy, you know, and here, Dad, I want to give this to you. His dad just going, yeah, about time, give me your candy, you know. Is that the way a dad acts, a loving dad? No. I mean, a dad is going to bless that child for their desire to be selfless. Why do we think less of God? That we think that God is going to be, oh yeah, well, I'm not really paying attention, or I don't know what, you know, he's old and senile and fat Santa Claus, right? I mean, we just have this wretched view of him. Verse 12, blessed is the man who perseveres under trial, under temptation, under being tempted to respond to circumstances in a way which is sinful. Don't trust God. Don't ask for God, not willing to be obedient to God. God might tell me something I don't want to do. I'm tempted to get angry, right? I'm tempted. Somebody struck out at me. So my spouse was unfair to me, or my spouse acted in a certain way to me, or somebody on the street, or somebody whatever acted, my boss, and I want to get angry, right? I'm tempted, right? I am tempted to exert my flesh sexually, emotionally, you know, financially, whatever it is, okay? But blessed is the man who perseveres under trial. For once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. I would say we should put a lot more weight on that. We are so immediate gratification. God says, man, you won't be outgiven. The crown of life. Let no man say when he is tempted, okay? When there's a trial in front of you, when there's a test in front of you, when you've got, you know, whatever it is in front of you, that you are tempted to, okay, do I take control of this or do I submit to God in this? Okay. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. Okay. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. Well, that seems to be a contradiction of what you were just saying, right? That God does test us. That God allows tempting. God does not test us by evil. Okay? Understand that. You know, if I am tempted to think sexually about some woman besides my wife, that's not God doing it. And one of the things that I think is very critical in understanding this is that there's a huge propensity in our Christian culture to say, well, I can't help it. That's the way God made me. Right? I can't help it. You know, that God made me over sexual. That I can't help it. God made me overly emotional. I can't help it. God made me with a fiery temper. I can't help it. God made me with insecurity. I can't help it that God made me, you know, all those things are a result of Satan, not the result of God in your lives. Okay? God does not deal. When we say, God made me this way, I can't help it, and use it as an excuse for sin, that's what he's talking about here. God does not tempt with evil. Okay? So to say that this is the way God made me is to say, God tempts me with evil. Right? That I am feeling sexual towards somebody other than my wife, in, you know, whatever might be the circumstance in doing it, and God made me this way, and that's just a man. I've heard that so many times, I just want to punch somebody in the face, okay? When you guys say that to me, I probably will. Okay? Oh, that's just a man. That's just a man who has been determined by the enemy. That is just a man who has been determined, his character has been determined by Satan, his habits, the thought process of his mind, the way that he connects information, his synaptic connections in his brain have been formed by the enemy. Not by God. Did God make us sexual creatures? Absolutely. He meant it to glorify him in holiness in an intimate relationship with a man and a wife. He meant it to be that way. Okay? God meant us to be sexual creatures in holiness. Okay? Flourishing it in sexuality in holiness. Outside of that, it's perversion. Okay? Period. And God, if I am sexually attracted to somebody besides my wife, that's perversion. And that's a side of me that has been allowed to form. That is not God made me that way. That is not God tempting me. Okay? That's what we tend to say. If my anger is such and I can't control my anger, God just made me this way. Okay? My insecurity, God just made me that way. No. God didn't create you insecure. The enemy destroyed the parenting of your mother and your father to cause you to be an insecure child. He caused you to have to come up in survival and raise, meet your own needs and struggle to get your own needs met because your parents failed you. That was not God forming that character in you. That was the enemy forming that in you. God does not tempt with evil, and we cannot use the excuse, God, that's just the way I am. Well, a sinful man, a rebellious to God, rebellion to God, yeah, stand on that one. And then say, and God, so you need to be okay with that, because I'm a sinful man in rebellion to you. How do you think that excuse is going to go? I'll just say not well. At all. It's not going to go well. Each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. Okay? Again, that's not just a sexual thing. Okay? When somebody responds to me, I've got a choice to be obedient to God, to put my faith that God is sovereign. God calls me to love this person. God calls me to care about this person. Or my lust, my insatiable desire to exert my flesh. My insatiable desire to strike out in anger. My insatiable desire to retaliate, to be vindictive, to defend, to protect. When I give in to that, when I give in to lust, when he's enticed by his own lust, when lust is conceived, when that desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. That never achieves the righteousness of God. Understand that. Acting in sin does not achieve the righteousness of God. Okay, so to think that we're going to accomplish something, think that we're going to defend and make ourselves more secure, to think that I'm going to strike out at this person, make sure I'm protected, to think that I'm going to have sexual thoughts, relations, whatever, and think I'm going to be, is not going to happen. To think that I'm going to take this money and make myself more happy is not. It says sin results in death. Do not be deceived, my brethren. I think that's a big one. Do not be deceived, my brethren. Okay? I don't know. Some of you might be offended that I said, I don't think Joel Osteen is speaking for God. And I don't think that whole prosperity doctrine is something that, because it's not biblical. He says, rejoice in your humble circumstances. Count it good. Okay? And by humble, it doesn't just mean, you're in the lower scale. You're living in Bellevue, you know. The humble, I would contend, has to do also with society, right? That you're lowly, because that's what the word means. It means lowly. Regarding society as lowly, okay? It says rejoice in that. Because being content in that and trusting God in that is a sweet place to be. I mean, all of us should regard subsistence living, being taken care of day to day by our God and our Father is a wondrous state of existence. No different than life insurance policy, you know? What does that look like? I mean, I'm obviously facing that, you know? I'm getting old, man. What do I have? Nothing. I am old, okay. I know. So, but older, okay? What does that look like? I don't know. It's going to be a ride, right? I already tried to teach my kids they're going to have to change my diapers. They're not in for it yet, but, you know. Hopefully that'll never happen. So, hopefully. God knows. Humble circumstances, you know what he says? You know, doing it, so. But what does that look like going for this ride for the rest of my life? You know, what does it look like living this life out? You know, I mean, I can tell you it's been a sweet ride the last 10 years. It's been the worst financial time of my life, literally. Okay. Life's good. You know, I couldn't, you know, God has protected our home. You know, God has, I mean, we got to the point, didn't have it. You know, one of the sweetest memories of one of the three sweetest mementos, you know, of God's provision and blessing, even though I wouldn't ask anybody to go through the supposed stress, you know, is a stack of foreclosure notices that were put on the door about this tall over years. You know, you're out of here. You're done. You're not paying. All I know. What are you going to do about it? And it was interesting. They called me up. David, what are you going to do about this? I don't know. Well, how are you going to pay this? God knows. You know? Here we are. Still in my house. Okay? God is good. God has blessed us. You know, He's kept our cars running and, you know, it's been a super sweet ride. You know, have I been poor? I can't say, well, I've been impoverished. You know? I mean, when you're trying to slim down to go hunt a mountain goat, it hasn't been too bad, has it? You know? I mean, you want to, you know, I mean, life has been good, you know. I mean, I couldn't be more blessed, you know. I mean, a passel of kids and a passel of grandkids and a church body that I wouldn't trade for anything. You know, I've got a family, a church family that I wouldn't trade this for anything. You know, that was kind of the road that we went down, you know. David, you're supposed to be the shepherd. Well, that's really a bad idea right now, man. I can't even pay my mortgage, you know. And all the rich people ran out, you know. So how's that going to work, you know? Everybody else left in the church didn't have jobs at the time, you know. That's not going to go very well for tithing, is it, and paying stuff. God has been a sweet ride that I wouldn't trade for anything. And again, there's no way I can scream poor. I mean, I still have a lot to learn in that too, in being content. Very difficult in our culture. Especially with Amazon, right? I mean, what a wretched temptress, right? I mean, what's that? Anything, and just push the click button. You don't even have to go through, you know, the whole procedure and come up with the credit card. And just push the click button, man. You're going to be happy now, right? I mean, you know, whatever it is, pair of socks. Oh, man, happy now. Click. You know, I mean, it's a temptress. I mean, it's like porn, right? Only materialism, right? It just is there. You know, well, I'm not having a very good day. I'm not feeling very happy. If I buy something, I'll feel better, right? You know, if I just get something this little, you know, doesn't matter. You know, just something, or just maybe I'll just lust after looking at it because it's even fun just to lust, you know, after it. You know, how about this? What if I had that? Oh, how would I feel if I had that? Or what if I did this? You know, it's a mess. You don't even have to get in your car and put some energy forward, right? You just sit there on your stupid phone or computer and do it. I mean, it's a very, very dangerous society we have. And I would contend that, you know, Amazon is like a drug, man. It's like, you know, I'll pick on them. I don't know what else there is out there, but I just know it's like a drug, you know? Gee, I can just feel a little bit better if I just click. Dang, I'm not feeling better, you know. But I thought I would. I mean, all the anticipation leading up to it, looking at it and going back and look at it again, listen after it, thinking, look it up. Oh, yeah, it's still there, man. I could just buy it. Oh. It just, we live in a very dangerous society where our contentment, and that, what's sin? Lusting is sin on anything except for God. Maybe my wife. It's all right for me to lust after my wife a bit, you know, isn't it? I wouldn't say insatiable desire. It's pretty satiable. Holiness and sexuality is satiable. That's a wondrous thing. That's a distinct thing from outside of, from perversion, is that holiness is satiable. And that's sexuality is satiable in holiness, put it that way. So I probably wouldn't be lust because it's not an insatiable desire, right? do it. Stop, Dad. Okay. So, there's a couple things that I would just challenge all of us to try to reorient our thinking on. One is circumstances should not determine us in what we do and how we act and how we feel and how our life does. We should look at them and go, you know, it's no different than if you're a really good parent. Are you going to push your kids beyond what they think they can take? If you're a good parent, you are. Right? If you want your kids to grow, you're going to allow that to happen. You're going to, you know, their limit's right here, you know. They think they can't walk anymore up this hill. You're going to say, no, we're going to go up here, right? Why? Because next time they're going to go, oh, yeah, no problem, man. I'm up that hill. And then you're going to go, well, why don't we go up this hill, right? Over here. I can't. Yeah. Come on, let's do it. Next time, oh, good. We're all good, right? We all push our children if we love them because we want them to grow. We want them to mature, you know, whatever level, you know, on, you know, sharing, you know, little kid, you know, you get a 1-year-old has his baby, you know, does he have to give it up and let everybody else go play with it and sit there and watch, you know, doing it? Well, you're probably going to be a little nicer and teaching him the process, you know, doing it. And, you know, you're going to gently ease him into the fact that someday you're going to have to give it up and watch while other people play with your toy. And that's okay, you know, doing it. But you ease him into it and push him beyond what they're able, you know. Have them share it. No, they want to, can you share your toy with so-and-so? Right? And that's a parent word, you know, you do. Can you share your toy? No. You just share it. Okay, share it. Oh, now you did it. You're a good person. Now, can you share your toy back with him? You doing it? You know, I mean, we try to be slowly work our children into doing it and push them beyond what they think they're capable of doing. That's no different than us. When they don't have money for bills and don't have this or, you know, God is allowing us to be pushed beyond what we think we're able. God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, but will with the temptation provide a way of escape. You might endure it. That doesn't mean you get out of it or run away from it. It means you go, okay, God, I trust you. You're in charge. I'm not going to act in an angry way. I'm not going to be angry at you. I'm not going to strike out at my spouse because I'm uptight. I'm not going to strike out at my kids because I'm uptight. I'm going to rest in peace and contentment and trust you, God, that you're going to do this and put you to the test. That's what testing is. That's what temptation is in front of us, that we are to be pushed. The other thing is that we need to reorient our thinking on is materialism. And that is something that I would contend you better go after hard, because this culture is relentlessly feeding you its position. Relentlessly feeding you its position. Everything about relentlessly is getting pumped into you what this world's perspective is on materialism. Okay? How are you going to balance that unless you put effort into it? You're not. Okay? You're going to struggle with it. And don't use the excuse that that's the way God made me. God does not tempt with evil. The enemy formed you. It is the way you are, probably, but that's because the enemy has formed and shaped us. And God wants to eradicate that and renew our minds, renew our synaptic connections. I, as a man, do not have to look at a girl and think lust and think sexually. Don't. Jesus didn't. Well, he was perfect. He was a man as we are and tempted in every way as we were. He just didn't connect those synaptic connect, those responses to stimuli, okay? Synaptic connections, responses to stimuli. He just did not form those wrong in rebellion. Okay? We formed them wrong in rebellion from a little kid. So you wonder, why do we think sexually when I look at other women doing it? Well, because you programmed your brain wrong, and the enemy is always relentlessly going to try to push that issue. Doesn't have to be that way. It, in fact, doesn't have to be that way. It's absolutely not supposed to be that way. Okay? No different than women, you know. Why do women want to elicit a sexual response out of men? In the way they dress, and the way they act, and the way they move, and the way they, you know. Why? Well, because it's a little rush, man. And it's like a little adrenaline, which I feel better about myself. You know? Whether it's in the grocery store, I mean, that second look makes me feel better. You know, makes me, you know, workplace, one of the worst stinking places. What a stinking mess. You know, girl does her best, dresses her best, acts her best, performs her best, is on her game doing it. And she goes, oh, you're looking so good today. Oh, you're acting so good. She gets cooties. What do you do with that? You know, is that a right thing that you're eliciting that response from men? Because women do it. Don't say you don't, because it's a lie. You don't do it if you fight against it and you come against it. Reprogram, because you were taught to do it as a little kid. And the way you dress and the way you act to get that little rush, that little stimulus, that make me feel better. You know, why do women like going to work? Well, because that jackass at home doesn't tell me how cute I am. You know, he doesn't tell me how pretty I am or how good I look. Man, I get cooties at work. There's a relentless and long list of ways the enemy forms and shapes us to keep us from being godly people, to keep us from knowing God. Because we will live in rebellion and refuse. We will be, when we are tempted, we will choose to act wrongly. When we are tested, we will choose not to trust God or do it God's way. We know better. And He purposely works that in us. But there is another way. And God, I am thankful that I'm thankful. Thankful seems like such a pathetic word to talk about you killing Jesus in my place because my flesh is deserving of death. And my rebellion to you is worthy of death. My not trusting you causes me to be worthy of death. By not honoring you, by saying you're not trustworthy, by not honoring you, by not fearing you, all those things are worthy of death, and you killed Jesus in my place. And give us the ability not to continue to live in our flesh, but don't have to worry about the ramifications of sin. You say that we can participate in the resurrection power of Jesus, the same power that raised his fleshly body from the dead, you say, can be at work in us to raise us from the dead, from being dead in our trespasses and sin. There's a new way. We can truly be born again. We can live in joy, in peace, in contentment, in security, in happiness outside of the circumstances around us. God, please teach us. Please give us a glimpse of hope about that we can be content outside of the terrible merry-go-round of materialism that we live in a culture on that is just relentless and unending. Cause us not to consider the click button on Amazon a friend. Cause us not to want more. My God, it would be a pretty sweet ride if we understood your heart and said, I want less. I want less of this world, man. I want more of you and less of this world. Because that's what you created us for. That's what you created us to live in joy and peace and happiness and fulfillment and security and intimate relationship with you. Or we don't regard this. The world isn't our home. The things of this world are temporal. They're like the grass. They'll burn out. We shouldn't envy them. We shouldn't even desire them. So God help us all. We live in a pretty nasty, ugly world when it comes to that. Consumed by it. Please, God, help us. Help us to consider our view of circumstances, our view of wealth, and our view of where our response can be towards tough times. Emotionally, materially, financially, physically. That you are always God. You are always God. Never are you off the throne. Amen.